What if the way you feel when you walk into a room isn't random at all? What if your brain is quietly scanning the light, the colors, the shapes, the textures, and deciding in milliseconds whether you feel calm or on edge, open or guarded? What if the way a space makes you feel isn't just preference, but biology? Welcome to Embodied. I'm Kathy Covington, and this is a podcast exploring the science of living well, mind, body, and connection. I'm coming to you from Dubai at the Global Wellness Summit, surrounded by leaders rethinking health, design, and human potential. Today, we're diving into neuroaesthetics, the science of how our brains respond to beauty, movement, and the environments we live in every day. It's the language for something we've all felt. Why certain spaces calm us, why others activate us, and why beauty plays a real role in how we think, feel, and show up in the world. I'm joined today by Dr. Anjan Chatterjee, a neurologist, professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and founding director of the Penn Center for Neuroaesthetics. Welcome, Dr. Chatterjee. It's truly an honor to have you here today. And I would like to start off by having you share a little bit more on your background and what inspired your incredible research into the world of neuroaesthetics.
It's a great question. Thanks. So just by way of background, I'm a cognitive neurologist and a cognitive neuroscientist. And I started by studying basic aspects of cognition. The general domain is trying to find how the mind is implemented in the brain. And so I was studying language, I was studying various aspects of perception. And at one point, somebody asked me what I would regret if I hadn't studied. That was around 1998. And it seems to be a fundamental part of the human experience. And I thought if I never studied that, I would regret it. And back then in the late 90s, there was virtually nothing written about this. Nobody was investigating this. There's maybe one or two people in the world, and that was it. So that's how I got started. It really was driven by the idea that this is something I cared about. It seemed to be something fundamental about the human experience, and neuroscience hadn't really addressed it at all.
True pioneer.
I mean, only in retrospect does it feel that way, but at the time it was, this is so interesting, and there's so many big questions to be asked.
You went on to study it in more depth, ended up writing a book.
Did write a book. I wrote a book called The Aesthetic Brain, How We Evolved to Enjoy, and I'm trying to think of what the subtitle was, How We Evolved to Enjoy Art and or Enjoy Beauty and Want Art, something like that.
For someone hearing the word neuroaesthetics for the first time, how would you explain it in a way that immediately lands for them?
Yeah, so just if you take the word, it implies, neuro implies, we're talking about the brain and how the brain responds, and aesthetics is a kind of experience. So we are interested in the nature of aesthetic experiences. Why do we have certain reactions to beauty, whether that's beauty in people or places or things? And in this case, things, we often think about art. And why does that matter? And for most people, they have their own intuitions about what they like, what they find beautiful. So that's really one of the driving forces around this. We think of aesthetics as encompassing more than just beauty, and not just, I mean, beauty is a lot, but we think of a whole panoply of emotional experiences of how you feel that can include things like wonder or awe or curiosity, all of these kinds of emotions that happen in the context of aesthetic experiences. So if you go about your life and you think about your day from the minute you wake up, you look around in your bedroom, you know, what are the colors of the walls? What do you have hanging in your bedroom? You know, you go into the bathroom. If you have a morning ritual, what is that ritual? How do you decide how you want to look, what clothes you want to wear, you know, the furniture in your house. These are all aesthetic decisions that people make. So we live in a world in which we are surrounded by aesthetic choices that we've either made or someone has made for us. And so trying to understand that and trying to understand how that enhances our life and gives us a sense of flourishing. The other way to think about it that people I think, get a good intuition about is I sometimes suggest that you can imagine what a world would be like if there was no aesthetics. So imagine that everybody has clothing that keeps them warm and safe. Everybody has a home that keeps them safe, protected from the elements. But everybody lives in exactly the same kind of home. Everybody wears exactly the same kind of clothing. Everybody eats exactly the same kind of food that is completely nutritious and meets our needs, but there's no real flavor to it, right? So those would be the kinds of intuitions that people get a sense of why it is that it's not enough just to be safe and protected, that in a world without aesthetics, it's just not a very, it's not the kind of world most people wish to live in.
It's very bland.
It's very bland. You're safe, but it's bland.
Right. Basic needs have been met.
Yes.
And then we can build. We build from there.
We build from there.
Next question for you. I guess it goes back to, when did scientists first realize that beauty wasn't just emotional or cultural, but it was actually neurological? And what do you think shifted the field?
So there is a background to this. If you go back even, so Edmund Burke had written about the way he thought physiology might have something to do with beauty or something to do with aesthetic experiences. And then in the 1950s, there was quite a famous American psychologist named Daniel Berline, who's one of the first people who also started to think about how physiology relates to beauty. And he had various ideas of arousal and so on about ways in which our nervous system had influenced how we reacted to beauty and different kinds of aesthetic experiences. I think what happened is a few things happened simultaneously, which is in the 80s and 90s, there was more of an interest in our brain and the way in which various aspects of cognition were implemented in the brain. So there was a general interest in that. And at the same time, in psychology, people started to get more interested in how things we had learned from or thought we knew about in psychology, how that was informed by or modulated by understanding of neuroscience. So all of that was coming together. And there had been an area of scientific aesthetics for a number of years that was not based in neuroscience. And so as those things came together, I would say in the 90s and especially in the 2000s, there was both a beginning interest in aesthetics as being a domain of science, and the methods were being developed. And so I think that's where it started. And then around 2011, 12, 13, there's a real inflection point where the whole field started to take off. And so I'd say in the last 10, 12 years, where we've been in an accelerated phase of this field. What was amazing to me is how many young people are interested in this, overwhelming interest. And at this point, I get, I'd say on average, 3 to 5 emails, cold emails a week from students around the world or other people around the world, young, and even young professors.
Like Emily, who sat next to us yesterday. Yes. She was so interested.
Yeah.
She's so young.
And she's so young. And so this interest is really coming from the next generation, which makes me optimistic about it. But it's at the point where I just don't have the bandwidth to answer everybody's emails because they're so sincere. They're so thoughtful. And I just, you know, so I have other people in the lab that answer for me. But just as a measure of, I think, how this field is growing and I think has a healthy future.
Fascinating. Yeah. Especially with the youth. If that's the next generation that are coming up, that they can carry on the work. Do you think our response to beauty is universal, or does culture shape the way the brain reacts?
I think it's both. So, you know, just if we think about the brain's response to beauty, we think about, I'll make some general comments and then talk about the specific.
Sure.
If we think about this framework that we use, which is called the aesthetic triad, that has three components, one having to do with the sensory and motor qualities of whatever you're engaged with, the second having to do with the emotions that are evoked, and the third having to do with the way in which we bring our own knowledge and meaning systems to bear on the experience. Right? So all those three things are happening at the same time. Within the brain, when we respond to beauty, there are what we call both domain-specific and domain-general brain responses. So by domain-specific, I mean that if you're looking at something, it's going to be part of the visual cortex. If you're listening to music, it's going to be part of your auditory cortex. If you're smelling something beautiful, like a perfume, it's going to be part of the olfactory cortex. So this differentiates what the source of the information is. And then if it's beauty, typically we experience reward and pleasure, and that's going to be more domain general. So all of the sensory inputs feed into those areas, and that's going to be more common across different people's experiences. And then the third has to do with what our own background is. So one thing we know that when people have a certain kind of expertise in a domain, so if we talk about architecture, that people have some knowledge or training in architecture, their responses are different, and that parts of the brain that organizes our memory and our knowledge systems, typically in the temporal cortex, is also activated in a way that might not for someone else who doesn't have that kind of knowledge. So again, you take this apart, and that there are some things that are general and some things that are specific. And then within that, if you say in the occipital cortex, if we're talking about people, places, or things, there's different real estate in our visual cortex that is tuned to people. When we look at faces, we look at people's bodies, there's certain parts of the brain that does that. When we think about landscapes or the built environment, there's a different part of the brain that does that. And we think about objects in general, there's an adjacent area. So those areas get activated for specific, you know, if you're looking at a portrait or a person, you're going to have the face area activated. Now, going back to your bigger question, so this is by way of background, is how much of this is universal and how much of it is cultural? What seems to be the case is that for natural objects, and by that I mean people and natural landscapes, there's more consistency in how people react to what they're looking at. But for human artifacts, which is going to be art and architecture, things are much more variable. And so you see more variability in the things we have made and people react to it versus the things in nature that we think our brains largely adapted to respond similarly. And that's not to say there isn't a lot of variability even within that, and there are reasons for that. But broadly, we tend to be more consistent with natural objects and less consistent with human artifacts.
So the cultural part does have a play.
It's sometimes worth thinking about how, you know, we typically talk about culture and brain as though they're separate things. And it always doesn't always play out that way, in the sense that culture has an effect on the organization of our brain. And you have a collection of brains is what creates culture. So a very, very easy kind of an intuitive example would be if you think about reading and writing, this is something that is a cultural artifact that we have. For most of humanity, people didn't know how to read or write. Very small groups of people knew how to do that. Now, at least most people in America know how to read or write to some degree. Within occipital cortex, there is an area called the visual word form area. In the same way that there's an area for people, places, and things, there is an area that actually deciphers these squiggles that we call letters into words, right? If you haven't learned how to read, that area is not tuned for that kind of information. So that's an example where a cultural creation, right, that you have to learn, right? You can't just look at words on a sheet of paper and learn how to read, right? You have to be taught that. So it's a way that culture actually informs how we think, and at the same time actually rewires the brain into creating this area called...
I'm thinking about architecture in different parts of the world, just how that's different here in Dubai, where we're sitting right now. And the influences maybe of what you see in India, and, or what you see in here in the Middle East and different areas. and the architecture influencing the cultural the way we think or react to art is probably different.
Yeah, I mean, certainly our background, what we're exposed to, what we know, plays a big role in it. With, you know, with architecture, partly what we feel most comfortable with, that can vary by culture. There are some places that are much more colorful and vibrant and other places that are more pared down. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in India, and a common response for people from India when they move to the States is, where's all the color? You know, the people tend to find, you know, buildings and walls, you know, in many American homes, walls tend to be off-white or cream. In the American South, there's a difference, which I lived in both northern Florida and Alabama for several years. There's more color and vibrancy in some of the American South. But that's an example where people bring a certain sensibility from their own culture, and they arrive and things look different.
The colors in India seem very vibrant.
Yeah, and it's everywhere.
It's a cultural. So tell me, what actually is happening in the brain in that moment when you walk into a space and it just feels right? And I was talking to you yesterday about this in the studios in terms of studio design. So it's like what's going on in our brain when we walk into a place and we're like, this just feels like home. This feels right here.
Yeah. So in our work, we found that there are three components to how people respond to the built environment. And we call them coherence, fascination, and hominess. And just to clarify what those are, coherence is a sense of legibility. Do you understand what's going on? Does it make sense to you? Does the organization of the space fit with how you need to engage with it? So you can imagine a kitchen, for example, that's coherent, that it's kind of a workspace and everything makes sense for how things are organized, where your sink is, where your stove is, where your fridge is. You know, there's a kind of coherent organization to it. Fascination is this idea that there is something about the space that has a certain amount of complexity, and it makes you want to explore it, that you're intrigued by it. It is of interest. Wow. And it engages your attention. And the third one is hominess, which you alluded to a little bit, which is you come into the space and you feel at home. You feel like you're in your skin, that you're completely at ease in that space. And when all three of those, there's a sweet spot for all three of those when you get it just right, that people feel at their best. So something we call valence, which is feeling good or feeling bad, that's the spot where people typically feel at their best.
Makes sense. Fascination, I think we did touch on that yesterday, and intrigue with the space when they walk in, like what's intriguing about being in a certain place, whether it's a museum,
yeah,
or in a studio.
In studios, I would imagine, as soon as people cross the threshold, do they feel like they still want to approach? Do they want to engage with the space? Mm-hmm. That's going to be some combination of all of these three, that you want people to feel at home as soon as they come in. They're not alienated. They don't want to rush out the door as soon as they walked in. And they're intrigued, so they're fascinated by it. But it's not chaotic where they don't know, you know, where they're supposed to be going.
So that's where the coherence comes into place, like the organization and so everything makes sense.
Everything makes sense.
Like you're talking about the kitchen, like, and that's where I know in kitchen design where you have that triangle, right? Or the sink to the fridge to the stove, and keeping everything organized in a certain way so that there's that coherence and the fascination. And the last one, which, like you mentioned, I always work with or not, I don't struggle with it, but I am very attuned to the idea of hominess. If you can talk more about that.
Yeah, it's in some ways, it's the one that is least formally studied. And it is also harder because we were talking about cultural background. And I think exactly what people find homey is going to be different for different people. Safety is a really important thing.
I was just going to say, what about, safety?
You got to be safe, right, to feel that. That's it, at a minimum. You know, but then is it about the colors of the space, the sort of textures that you're around? One of the things we know is that people tend to prefer curvilinear shapes over rectilinear shapes. So hard angles tend to feel a little bit hostile.
Like, really?
And if you can try to minimize those. And in some ways, you can think about the fact that in nature, there are almost no right angles. You know, most of nature then tends to be curvilinear, tends to be more complex. And then we go into a room like this one where all of the walls, these are right angles. They're hard edged, as opposed to the chairs you and I are sitting on, which are more circular. But there is a preference for roundedness over sharp corners. And that's another aspect of what makes people feel comfortable.
And the hominess factor.
The hominess factor, yes.
When we talk about safety and hominess and how the brain processes that, I think about the idea of not being judged in a space. And this is probably diving a little bit more into psychology, but someone feeling safe and that they're not being judged.
Absolutely. And this is where, you know, when we talk about people, places, and things, in reality, they all kind of merge together. So, you know, this is where in a studio, the staff becomes really important. Oh. They're going to have a big role of whether people feel comfortable or not, apart from the built environment, right? Do they feel homey? You know, you come to a hotel like this where we are. What is the staff like when you come into the, when you're trying to check in from the very beginning? Those human and social interactions play a big role in how comfortable you're going to feel in that space as well.
I don't want to go off topic too much, but what's happening in the brain? What's lighting up in the brain when we're experiencing this?
Yeah. So we have found, again, within visual cortex that there are different areas that respond to both to coherence, fascination, and hominess, that there's separate real estate for that, and that is actually that our brains are reacting to those components even when we are not explicitly thinking about it or aware of it. Right? So it says that our brains are always responding to the aesthetics of the environment. And we think that has an effect on our behavior, again, even if we don't necessarily know about it or conscious that it's happening, is one thing. And when it all fits together, we think that these reward areas that I was telling you about are also activated simultaneously. So you get that sense of sort of pleasure from the environment that's happening in the brain. There's one other piece to think about, which is that, you know, our body physiology, we tend to divide between, in the autonomic nervous system, between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. And that's an important concept for people to get, which is that the sympathetic nervous system is what revs us up. It's what increases our heart rate. It increases our blood pressure. It's the kind of activation part of the nervous system, right? So you get a little sweaty, you know, you get a little nervous, you're ready to do something. The sympathetic nervous system activates that. That's where the adrenaline, epinephrine, all of that comes through that. The parasympathetic nervous system is what is more of the calming things. It slows your heart rate down. It slows your breathing down. And the point is not that one is better than the other. You know, it just depends on the context in which you are. If you're about to run a race, you want to make sure your sympathetic nervous system is coming online because, you know, you have to be... Fight or flight. So in this case, flight, be ready for that. But if you're talking about hominess specifically, that's about relaxing, right? You want a situation where the parasympathetic nervous system is more activated than the sympathetic nervous system because that's, you know, if you think about you come home, you want to relax, you want to get sort of... have all of the stresses of the day wash off of you. You know, that's when you want to chill. So the conditions in which the parasympathetic nervous system then becomes important.
Okay, that's so interesting. Because to break it down like that between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, and I wonder if there's almost like a dance between the two that happens to create the ambiance.
Absolutely. I think, and again, it becomes contextually dependent. So we talked earlier about fascination. Fascination tends to be associated with more arousal and more of the sympathetic nervous system, because mm-hmm. it's really, you want to be engaged, you're interested, you want to explore, right? So that has more to do with the sympathetic nervous system, as opposed to hominess, that has more to do with the parasympathetic nervous system. And so, again, finding the right balance of that in the right context is really what you're aiming for.
Or maybe even looking at it in a different way, the frequency of that, like the highs and the lows of the journey when you're in a particular space.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. Do you think our brain is actually hardwired to seek beauty, or do we just learn to value it?
I talk about this a fair amount in the book that I mentioned, The Aesthetic Brain. I think our brains are hardwired to seek beauty. And part of the argument for that is that if you think about how the brain evolved over time, there are certain kinds of preferences that were adaptive and helped with survival and reproduction. And those were built into the brain. And so we are programmed to seek certain kinds of experiences. Many of them are beautiful. Now, that gets moderated a lot. And then there's also this idea that the environment in which our brains evolved are sometimes quite different than the environment we find ourselves right now. And so that can also screw us up, sometimes referred to as the mismatch hypothesis. So a simple example that most people can to get an intuition about this. In our ancestral environment, access to things like sugar and fat was scarce. This, and we need that for energy. And the craving, the desire for sugar and fat was something that was hardwired in our brain because that was predisposed to survival. People who had that craving, right, they had enough energy, and over time, that gets built into the population because that's the population that's going to survive in those climates. So now, if you are in many industrialized places, let's use US as an example, you know, you can hardly walk 100 yards without cornucopia of sugar and fat. And so that same craving that was built into our brains, now one of the consequences of that is the kind of prevalence of obesity we have in the U.S. So here's something that was built into the brain, a preference that was really important at a certain period in time.
But no longer serves us.
No longer serves us because we've created an environment in which it starts to harm us.
And that's what we see today with obesity rates rising.
With obesity rates rising. You know, and to some extent, you can think about, you know, we've talked about, you know, being in Dubai or places that are highly urbanized, the way in which, just think about light, you know, how important light is for sleep and circadian rhythms, you know, but we have all these shiny objects around us that unless you have really, you know, curtains at night that can really darken your room, it's really hard to not be affected by light pollution at this point in our urban environment. And that's something we've created.
That didn't exist 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. Yeah. Light pollution.
Yeah, light pollution. And you can talk about noise in the same way, noise pollution, the way in which that there's so much noise around us that can be exhausting.
Yeah, yeah. Comforting can be comforting.
Yeah.
But it can be exhausting. And it wasn't before. You said that beauty is not... beauty is not really luxury. It's a biology. And what does that mean for the way we live day to day?
Yeah, I think, you know, that example I gave earlier about what would a world be like without any beauty, mm-hmm. you know, is to give people an intuition of what that would be like. I think that there is a way in which we crave these experiences, that these pleasurable experiences to be built into our day that just makes for a more fulfilling and a richer life. And you can certainly exist without that, but most people would not find that a very fulfilling way to live.
So a question kind of going off of that, how do colors, shapes, and symmetry impact our cognition and our mood? And we spoke about this a little bit yesterday with Emily, how she said she could look at one piece of art one day and then, or I think it was art, and then another day she could hate it.
Yeah.
But it's the same beauty.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think there's always an interaction between whatever is going on in our physiology and what's going on in the environment. So colloquially, people will say, ask you, did you get up on the wrong side of the bed? Right? It's like you woke up and you're cranky, and then you've got your cranky glasses on, everything looks bad, right? I think most people understand this as a phenomena, that they experience it in their friends and people they like. So I think that's a factor. Another is when people colloquially talk about someone being hangry. So you're hungry, and somehow that gets manifested as just being pissed off at the world. So those are physiologic things that are happening that affects your mood. And, so I think there's always this two-way interaction of what is going on internally has an influence in how we interpret the world. And at the same time, what we're taking in from the world has an influence on our physiology. And how that communication, how that interaction plays out in different situations might be different. So I think, to Emily's observation, I think it really is that when something is different in one's physiology, it could be hunger, it could be because you're not nauseous, it could be because you've had a fight with your partner, right? That has nothing to do with the experience you're in now, but you still have the residue of that, the emotional hangover of that.
Right.
Colors how you experience the world.
About when we, with the same concept in design and environments and creating design and environments, how do the colors and shapes, and if we're thinking about studio design on a Pilates studio, how do the colors and shapes and the symmetry within the studio and these environments impact?
Yeah, so I think the colors, you want it to be, my guess, I'm not a studio designer and I've never done Pilates. Let's be clear about that.
Well, not yet.
Not yet.
Soon to come.
I mean, I think in the exercise areas, you'd want the colors to be more activating and the patterns to be more activating because you want people to be pumped up for what they're about to do. I think, again, in terms of shapes, I would say that, I suspect it still makes sense to avoid hard corners because that makes it feel less safe. I don't want people to feel safe at the same time that they're pumped up. I think symmetry, people tend to like symmetry, and that plays into coherence a little bit because when things are symmetric, you know exactly where things are, where they're supposed to be. So, in your studios, I would ask you probably have different kinds of spaces. It's not just one room, right? That's where you work out. What are the locker rooms like? What does the reception look like? And so all of those are serving slightly different functions. And so thinking about each of them as these transition spaces, like what is it you want to accomplish in this space?
Right. Makes sense. So going into mental health and well-being, do you think, or actually I'm kind of guess your answer a little bit, but can beauty actually play a role in healing or recovery?
I think so. There isn't a lot of research in this. Right now, one study in a substance use disorder facility where we have designed refresh rooms where people who are in recovery can choose to go in. And, so we designed the entire space, the furniture, the textures, the smells in there. There are some videos, nature videos and music that people can choose to look at. They can choose to turn up or down the light in there. They can adjust that. And we are collecting both information on their subjective feelings of stress, and we're collecting electrophysiology information there. So that's the kind of thing that I think you can do. And we don't have the data yet. It's an ongoing study. But we're hoping we can show that taking a stress population, that we might be able to create an environment in which their stress comes down. And they, in some ways, they can choose to self-medicate. They can choose when they want to go in there. So that's one example. One thing we have found, we recently published a big review looking at the use of artwork in clinical spaces. And it turns out that in high stress spaces, like you're about to get some kind of surgical procedure, so you're the waiting room for that, that if there are images of nature, that people generally find those more calming and they tend to appreciate those environments more. So I think there are these little things that can be done if it's done in a targeted way of saying, here's a population that in this environment, we know they're stressed, they're going to be stressed. What can we do to that environment to mitigate some of that?
And I think you were talking about showing pictures or patterns in nature.
Yes. So
that can be therapeutic.
We talk about biophilic design.
Biophilic design.
So biophilic design is this idea that how much of nature can we import in our interiors? And so there's the obvious things like plants, and they can bring in now in some places things like garden walls or moss walls are also popular. That's another way to introduce some of that. And then images of nature, whether it's through photography or painting, that's another way to do it. And then there is this idea that there are certain abstract patterns that are seen in nature, and sometimes they're referred to as fractal patterns. And the idea of fractals is the degree of self-similarity. So when you take, for example, a fern, that you have the overall structure, but each smaller unit recapitulates the same structure. So there's a kind of internal coherence to it. And there are certain fractal patterns that are found, especially in nature. And it looks like if you have, for example, your carpets or things on your wall, that even though they're not about nature, but they recapitulate that pattern, that those people also find more comforting.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Just subtle subconscious.
It's just in the background.
In the background.
Yeah.
That create the whole ambiance and activate the pleasure centers. When we talk about feeling like ourselves, is this also an aesthetic state? Like, I feel like myself when I'm here.
I think so.
I feel like I'm myself when I'm here talking to you.
Yeah. Well, it's an aesthetic conversation.
There we go.
I think this goes back to that safety, comfort, the hominess, like all of those sort of qualities tend to be sort of positively valenced that are part of a value system in our brain, of which aesthetics is an important part of it. Going back to this idea, you can be hungry, that's a version of not feeling yourself. You can, but then when you eat something, especially if it's, I guess that's where the aesthetics can come in, if it's also food that you like, but it doesn't have to be, right? You have that sense of satiety, right? That is, again, feeling like yourself, but in that case, the aesthetic might not be as prominent as it is in other situations.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about connecting the how does the brain connect beauty with identity? So the sense of this is me.
Yeah, that is a tough one. I don't know that I have a good answer to that. I think people, it's especially complicated now where the ways in which people use selfies on social media. And I think that makes it much more complicated than it ever has been. Because on the one hand, people have a certain amount of agency in depicting themselves, right? I'm choosing how I'm going to depict myself in the world. And one would think that that's a good thing to have that kind of agency. And at the same time, the way our social media is structured is that, and as this affects young people especially, is you're getting feedback on how you're presenting yourself. So how many likes you're getting or what kind of responses you get, and which makes it much more complicated, I think. And so what is your identity in terms of the way you look at this point is so mediated through social media. For many young people, I think it's much more complicated than it ever used to be. And as you may know, that the increase in anxiety and depression among young people, especially young women, has been really on the rise since about 2013.
Wow.
And that often people associate that with the widespread use of smartphones and these kinds of, and social media, in which so much of people's esteem, young people's esteem, which have, their brains haven't fully formed yet. They don't know who they are, and they're getting feedback on who they are based on how other people are reacting to them.
Which is, that's like you said, a whole other topic, and it's complex.
Whole other topic. And that's another one of these, you could argue, is part of this mismatch that I was talking about, right? We've created an environment in which this feedback we're getting about who we are is something that is not what our brains were designed to handle.
Yeah, it's definitely not social media. Definitely not all the social media feedback. Yeah, it just makes me, having the conversation just makes me think about the essence of, I don't know, this is a whole, like, could be another conversation too, just the essence of a person, mm-hmm. right? And what are they desiring when they're creating this image of themselves? And I guess do you think this is one last question in this area on demeaning and identity? It would be, is the pursuit of beauty ultimately a pursuit of meaning?
I think it can be. I think, you know, so I think about the pursuit of beauty as also a pursuit of values. It's a way to understand what it is we value. And in the same way that I was talking about the aesthetic triad, these experiences also feed back into our emotions and feed back into our meaning systems. And so there is a way, if you think about natural beauty, that you seek it out. Say you go to a stunning landscape in the American Southwest, for example, and you have these experiences of awe and wonder, right? That's one of those experiences where, you know, particularly awe has these components of a sense of vastness, that the person feels small, at the same time they feel connected to something larger. And that idea that you're connected to something larger starts to introduce a kind of meaning of, you know, how are we connected to everything else? So I think there are situations where the pursuit of beauty can be that. It tends to be in more sort of more complicated settings. So, I mean, you can say a little sugar on your tongue, there's a pleasurable experience. That's a kind of beauty, you know, but it's a very simple beauty. So I think when you have these more complex experiences of beauty, and certain kinds of artwork are very good at doing that. You know, artists can create this in the context of beauty, can create very complex emotional experiences that I think push people to ask those questions.
Complex in that they can be negative, right? Distasteful.
Sometimes they can be negative. And, you know, we're interested in how it is that sometimes people can go from feeling something negative to that becoming a source of transformation. There's one line of thinking in my world that having just a little bit of negative in a broadly positive experience actually makes the experience more powerful.
I agree with
that. Yeah, I do as well. The analogy I use is, you know, and this was actually told to me by a guy who had an orange farm in South Africa, of talking about, you know, as he's growing oranges, getting just the right balance of both sweet and sour in it. That if it's just sweet, it tastes insipid. And if it's just sour, people don't like it. But just having a little bit of sour in the sweet is where people really, really enjoy
the perfect alchemy.
Perfect alchemy.
So not too sweet, but in order to know sweet, we have to know sour to find that balance.
Yeah, find the balance.
What excites you most about where neuroaesthetics is headed in the next decade?
I think what excites me most is that all of these questions are still really wide open. I think that, you know, we've just scratched the surface, what I've told you. It's almost like, you know, you have a book, you open it up, and now you can see the table of contents, but the chapters are still waiting to be written. So there's so much more for us to learn. And at the same time, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, how much young people are interested in this, right? So you have this combination of, it's a wide open space and the next generation are keyed in on it. And so that combination makes it very exciting. It's whatever is going to happen in the next 25 years in this field.
So it's really created a movement.
I think so. I think that it is happening. And what's interesting also is that I think people are keying into this from other domains. So what started out as very much of an academic domain that people in universities were studying. For example, people in architecture are interested in this now. People in interior design are interested in this. You know, people who are thinking about, how do you structure museums, for example? How do you engage people? Even this idea of hominess. So museums have this complicated relationship with their communities where in some places, they're treated as these ultra-elitist institutions, which means that not everybody feels comfortable in those spaces. So museums are starting to get interested in this. So I think all of these adjacencies means that both the field gets more attention, but it also, I think, two what we were talking about before, it starts to create an environment where people feel as though aesthetics are not just a nice to have, but also a need to have, that these has really practical consequences.
I think, too, the thing about environments, you were mentioning the museums and how they create that feeling of hominess. Digital art now, right? When you're going into a digital art museum, yeah. I think they're doing a good job of creating that.
Yeah.
Especially how it relates to
others. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there is still that you have to, especially for young people who grow up in a digital environment, I think for them, this is comfortable in a way that for older people, there's still a bit of a, you know, there's still a bit of a disjunction when you walk in.
They can bring in, for the younger generation coming up, bringing in as they're exposed to more digital art, being on social media all the time, but creating these spaces using digital art seems like a wave of the future. I know there's the ABBA Museum here. I haven't gone yet, but I would like to. Digital Art Museum, and they've created one in Las Vegas that I was in as well. That is all digital art, which is I think relatable to a lot of people, maybe homey in a way, but then using these fractal patterns and all of these different ways of engaging our senses. And we didn't even talk about smells because I know we had some conversation about smell yesterday. But that's just of one of the senses that create the whole experience. Closing reflection. If you could offer one piece of guidance to anyone trying to create a more beautiful, intentional life, where would you have them begin?
I would have them begin with just being more aware in the moment of their environment. And, you know, they could use the aesthetic triad, as I mentioned, like, you know, just pause, think about your environment, think about the sensory qualities that are in the environment, think about how it makes you feel, like really query yourself how it makes you feel, and then think about when you're looking at the environment, what are your associations, let your mind wander, and try to think of how this fits with your life. And having that kind of awareness, it's almost like a take a break, pause, really be present in your environment, whether it's with your built environment, whether it's with someone else, whether it's with a work of art, whether it's with, you know, simple things, your tea kettle, the everyday objects you have around. And I think having that kind of awareness and sensitivity, I think then starts promoting people to really be conscious of their surroundings, to care about what it looks like in a way that I think ultimately is probably beneficial to their well-being.
What about maybe three keys to presence when looking at art?
Yeah, so this goes back to the triad, right? So that, and we do these kind of sessions to try to have people better engaged. So, for example, we have these exercises where people, for several minutes, up to 5 minutes, will just focus on the sensory qualities of art. So what are the colors, what are the patterns, the textures, the lines, the details? You can zoom in, you can zoom out, but just looking at just the visual properties of the art.
So that would be step one.
That would be step one. Step two would be querying yourself. Think of art as a way, as a vehicle for self-discovery. What are you feeling? What are you experiencing? And it doesn't, there's no right answer to this, right? It doesn't, just because some fancy art critic said this is great, it doesn't mean
it's great to you.
It's great to
beauty
you.
Is in the eye of the beholder.
So you feel it. What is it you're feeling? What is it? It could be pleasure. It could be complicated. It could be you feel challenged. You feel repulsed. You feel angry. But it could be you're interested. It's making you're intrigued about it. And so just spend that time to find out what it is you're feeling as you're looking at it. And those feelings can change, right? It's not a static thing. Then spend a few minutes letting your mind wander off of that to think about, what are the associations I'm getting from this? How is this reminding me of something else? And how is any of this relevant to my life right now? And that's a way to, you know, it's just a heuristic for people to take the time and in a relatively organized way. And I think if you do this over and over, it starts to become second nature, that it's not so much that you're going through your head, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this. It just starts to become just part of how you engage with your environment.
And I remember you were telling me yesterday about when they give these three-step process to looking at art, you can have someone come in that maybe was never interested in this type of in this art ever before, but then once you have them sit there and then actually dive in and give them a sequence to follow and to become present, that they can become engaged and it becomes an enjoyable process versus a burden.
More engaged. I think, you know, it's very hard for people just to look at art for 15 minutes. It's not a pleasant experience if you don't know what to do. And if, especially if you haven't had a background in art, people, again, going back to this elitist thing, that people feel intimidated that they're not doing it right. And the point is, there is no right way to do it. These are guides, and that it's, you don't have to know anything about the artist or the art movement or what they were responding to. You know, that kind of information can help, but it's not by no means necessary, because you have yourself, who you are, what you're bringing to the experience is what's the most important piece. And this is just a way for people to feel comfortable engaging with it in a way that I do think helps people. People become more aware of themselves, but also find the experience more enjoyable.
And so in this whole space, too, of being present and this practice of presence that can happen within your environment, I think it just touches on a little bit on another topic that we talked about earlier, and that was stress management, right? And using these techniques to actually reduce stress. Been here over the course of the last 3 days, learning a lot about how stress impacts our health and the longevity of our lives, and reducing stress, finding beauty and purpose and meaning and different ways that are activated. I don't know. I find it fascinating to learn the science behind that and what your work is evolving and the awareness it's bringing, and also the movement it's creating in the youth that's coming up. So much that you can't answer emails and you may have to get a chat bot to do it for you. Or ChatGPT.
Yeah, that's a thought.
Or something of the sort. Thank you so much for your time and being here with me today. I mean, it's truly an honor. I value it, and it's very meaningful. And I'm sure a lot of people will find this conversation extremely impactful in how they look at neuroscience, in particular neuroaesthetics. This conversation reminds me of something we already feel in our bones. Our surroundings aren't background noise. They're actually an active part of our biology. The spaces we move through, the light we stand under, the textures we touch, the movement we choose. Hopefully it's Pilates, if you ever decide to try it, which I think you will. It's all shaping how we think, how we feel, and how we show up in the world. And when you understand that, you can then start making different choices. You start designing your life with intention. A lot of what this podcast is about, and bringing awareness to that. You're in designing with intention instead of default. You start noticing what lifts you and what drains you. And you realize that beauty isn't superficial. It's one of the most underused tools we have for well-being. Dr. Chatterjee, thank you again for bringing depth and a real science to the topic that touches every part of our lives. This is the kind of conversation that definitely stays with me and hopefully stays with you. And to everyone listening, pay attention to what your brain responds to. Notice what feels good, what expands you. It's where your energy rises. That awareness is where the transformation begins in fitness and in health.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks for being here today. Conversations like this can wake us up. They pull us out of autopilot and help us see our lives a little more clearly. I hope this podcast shifted something in you that can shape how you think in a way that feels powerful. Small shifts can change everything. If this episode resonated with you, please follow the show, leave a quick rating, and share it with a friend. That's how this knowledge spreads. See you next time.